This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Hello, and welcome to The Pulse, Issues in Healthcare. I'm Leslie Bruce, your host and the Director of Healthcare Leadership and Community Outreach for UC San Diego Extension. This show marks our third year of broadcasting interviews with leaders on vital topics related to healthcare. That calls for a celebration, or at the very least, acknowledgement of the people who have made and continue to make this possible. Thanks first to Beth Meyer, the Director of Online Learning at UC San Diego Extension, for getting the show launched and on such solid footing. Also to Brandon Chavez, our Marketing Manager, who never stops working to improve the quality and reach of the show. Thanks, too, are due to Mike Fausner and Alethea, who now record the show, including the video portion. And thanks to you, our listeners, for your interest and your loyalty. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this is a podcast where leaders of all stripes share their thoughts on the health-related issues of the day. Apropos of this special occasion is a special guest, Melissa Stafford Jones, the District Director of Region 9 of the United States Health and Human Services Agency. Region 9 covers a vast area, including Arizona, California, Hawaii, Nevada, Guam, and American Samoa, not to mention a few other more island nations as well. So welcome, Melissa.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Delighted to have you. You report to Health and Human Services Secretary Burwell, who, of course, reports to the President.
Yes.
Tell us how you came to be prepared for this role. What is your education and experience that lets you enable you to make this move?
Yeah. Well, much of my healthcare career has been in the healthcare safety net, with a real focus on making sure that everyone has access to the healthcare that they need for themselves and their families, particularly low-income people. And I've worked in the policy arena, both at the state level in California and at the national level on federal health policy issues, trying to make that real. And so, of course, the Affordable Care Act is one of the huge things in our history that is really advancing forward the ability of all Americans to get health coverage and get the health care that they need. And so I was thrilled when I had the opportunity to join the Obama administration to help implement the Affordable Care Act here in Region 9.
Gotcha. And so you have an MPH. How did you have the knowledge to assume such a role?
Yeah. So, yes, I did an undergraduate degree in biology. And I did a series of internships while I was an undergraduate, and it was actually at the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis. And that led me to doing something that I know students don't do quite as often these days, but sitting in the library with a giant book, now you would go online, of course, at all of the graduate degrees. And I literally flipped through that book for several hours. And when I saw the Master's in Public Health, I had an aha moment and said, that is what I'm looking to do. I'm looking to really think about healthcare from a broad population, community, societal perspective. And so that led me to a master's in public health degree from UC Berkeley, where I focused in particular on health policy. And out of that, I'd had a series of jobs. I believe very strongly that folks in policy are well served by a grounding in healthcare operations and the delivery of any kind of health or social services on the ground. And I spent a number of years working in a fairly large safety net health system to have that experience. And then I've had a series of roles working in the realm of health policy and found my way to my passion in terms of the work on the safety net. And before I joined the Obama administration, I had been the CEO of a health policy organization and trade association that specifically worked with large safety net healthcare systems and really worked, particularly in California, on state and national health policy that would help expand coverage, improve access and the quality of care in our healthcare system, and the beginnings of implementing the Affordable Care Act in California.
Very interesting. I think it's an interesting path. And as someone who teaches politics and public policy of healthcare, I was particularly interested in watching you move to this new role. And of course, we tried to connect in Washington when I brought the class. So that's how this all came about. So tell us then, what are your principal job responsibilities as director?
Yeah. So the regional director for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is the secretary's representative in the region. Mm-hmm. And so I often describe it to family and friends as, think of it as, instead of an international diplomatic role, in a way it's a domestic diplomatic role, because it allows us to really share what the priorities and work is that the department is doing in the region. And equally importantly, we really are on the ground. I spend a lot of time traveling and doing lots of meeting site visits, hearing about what is happening in the field, in health and human services throughout Region 9. And then I'm able to share that information back to the folks in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. Who are making different policy decisions and programmatic initiatives so that they have that real-world experience incorporated into the policymaking. So
it's a two-way communication.
It really is a two-way communication, and that's one of the things that I absolutely love about it is being able to share the work that we are doing with HHS to get people covered, but also to improve our nation's healthcare system, and at the same time sharing back what's happening on the ground here in Region 9, where it's working really well and we want to highlight some of the best practices, and other places where there may be challenges or issues and problems that we can work through and support the folks on the ground doing the great work they do to serve their community.
So being the representative for the secretary in such a vast region, that makes me think you travel a lot.
I do. I do. I travel quite a bit. And, you know, what's so terrific about that, though, is I really do have the opportunity to meet with so many incredibly smart, dedicated people in all different kinds of environments, you know, cities, counties, private sector. Working at all levels of government. We do a lot of work in terms of intergovernmental relations out of our office. So we mm-hmm. work with, you know, mayor's offices and state legislative offices, governor's offices, to know what their priorities and concerns and issues are. And I just find everywhere I go, there are so many smart, dedicated people who are really working to make healthcare and human services available to everyone who needs them, getting folks signed up for coverage, really working to make our health system better, and so we can really get to the goal we're all getting for, which is better health.
Right, right, for sure. Well, speaking of the Affordable Care Act, just months, of course, after it survived a second legal threat at the Supreme Court 2 days ago, a federal judge gave a boost to yet another major court challenge. Yet, report after report over the last couple of years from a wide variety of sources have said that the law is working and that healthcare leaders have stated that this is the right thing to do. So if all of that is true, then share with us, what are the results of the ACA in Region 9?
Yeah, yeah. A major focus, of course, of our work in Health and Human Services in Region 9 is working to implement the Affordable Care Act on the ground and with our partners in the field. And we've seen some really great results. So nationally, we know that more than 16 million Americans have gained coverage since the start of the ACA. And that number is so huge that sometimes I think it's hard to imagine what that means in human terms. And so I always have a visual in my mind of imagining like an 8x10 headshot photo of a person and trying to imagine 16 million of those arrayed around the room that I'm in. Mm. And then I really can think of that is how many people now have the peace of mind of knowing that they have health coverage. And if something, you know, God forbids, happens to themselves or a family member or a friend, they know they have that health coverage. They have the financial security of knowing that, you know, they're not going to go bankrupt if something catastrophic happens in terms of a health care need. And they have more access to, you know, the basic health services of primary care and prevention that are so important, because a key thing about the Affordable Care Act that is very important, and we certainly are seeing working, is many preventive services under the Affordable Care Act are now free when they weren't before. And that's not just for people who just gained coverage, but even in the Medicare program, if you have private insurance through your employer, many preventive services are now free. And so it's really an opportunity for people to be able to get that preventive care and take care of themselves early in the process before mm-hmm. Disease begins, or to helping manage chronic disease. So expanding the number of people covered is a huge accomplishment of the Affordable Care Act. We know that the uninsured rate has declined dramatically to about 11.4% from a high of 18%. So we know we are making really excellent progress on getting more Americans healthcare coverage. A key part of that, though, in addition to that access to coverage, of course, is affordability, because we know that the ability to afford healthcare is one of the reasons why people had previously been uninsured. And so it's something we take very seriously within HHS and are keeping our sleeves rolled up to continue to work on. But we have seen some good signs in terms of healthcare affordability increasing. In 2014, we actually saw some of the lowest growth in healthcare costs on record in almost 50 years since records have been kept. So we know that the rate of growth of healthcare has slowed. The projections for the next 10 years have it going up to around 5.8%, so a little higher than it was in 2014. But we also know that that's significantly lower than the historical rate of a little over 9% of growth that we had been seeing in healthcare costs. Yeah. So we know we're making progress, but we know we still have work to do to make sure that health insurance coverage is affordable, because clearly we know that those who remain uninsured, they're very price sensitive. They are more likely to get coverage, of course, if it's affordable. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important that people really explore their options when they're going to look for healthcare coverage. And I know we're going to talk about open enrollment probably a little bit later, but it's a really important piece of us improving affordability. We've also seen some really good success in affordability within the Medicare program, both because some of the Medicare premiums that our seniors pay are tied to the rate of growth in healthcare. So as that lowers, that helps keep the costs lower for our Medicare beneficiaries. But also an important part of the ACA was addressing the Medicare donut hole, as it's sometimes called, which is the price of prescription drugs for our seniors who are in Medicare. And we're working on closing that gap in coverage so that pharmaceuticals and critical prescriptions that our seniors need in the Medicare program are more affordable for them. So we know we're making some good progress on affordability as well as access. And then the third component that we really think about and work hard to pay attention to within HHS as to how we're doing in terms of improving our nation's healthcare system and health for people is looking at the issue of healthcare quality. And we've seen some very good improvements in healthcare quality in hospitals. We've seen a reduction in infections that people had been getting in hospitals, so we know we're making care safer. We've also seen a reduction in the Medicare program in readmissions, which is when a person leaves the hospital and comes back within 30 days, or sometimes it's measured within 90 days. And actually, you've got a coalition of hospitals working here in San Diego on that who have done a fantastic job making very dramatic improvements in reducing readmissions. And so we know that that can be done. You all are, you know, leading the way on that here in San Diego, which is just terrific. We've also seen improvements in the quality of care in our community health centers, which provide a lot of primary care to low-income patients, both in the Medicaid program, but also those who remain uninsured, and in Medicare, and in some cases, private insurance as well. But we've seen improvements in the use of medical homes and in the ability of community health centers to effectively manage chronic disease. So we know we're making progress in terms of the quality of care that we provide in our health system. We have more work to do on that front, and I think we have a lot of partners working together with HHS who are very committed to that.
Well, you should know that Rick Kronick, who is
with AHRQ, comes from San Diego.
Dear friend.
Absolutely.
He's from UCSD.
Yes, so yes, doing wonderful work.
Right, he certainly is, and I think quality is certainly important to everyone, as are these other components. I'm wondering how Region 9 stacks up against the country as far as progress in these three areas that you discussed.
Well, in terms of, in particular, the coverage aspect, so there are a couple of aspects within the Affordable Care Act that have allowed us to make this great progress on getting 16 million Americans coverage that did not have it before. One is states' expansion of the Medicaid program, which, as you know, is an option that they have under the Affordable Care Act. Then there are the exchanges, and in some cases, states set up their own, and some use the federal exchange for folks who are between 138% and 400% of poverty, where they can get financial help in getting coverage. And then, of course, we have young adults up to the age of 26 who can stay on their parents' coverage. And we also know the elimination of the ability to not get coverage due to pre-existing conditions. And in Region 9, one of the important factors of our success in getting coverage is that all the states in Region 9 have expanded Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's not true across the country. Unfortunately, it's something we're continuing to work on. But here in Region 9, all of the states have expanded Medicaid, and that provides a very significant base for that expansion to really take root and succeed and make sure that low-income folks now have health coverage. And then in terms of the exchange, of course, here in California, California has its own exchange that it created, Covered California, which has been very successful in getting folks enrolled, about 1.4 million people. And then in the state of Arizona, in Region 9, they use the federal exchange, and we saw a dramatic increase in exchange enrollment this past open enrollment, and we're really hoping to see that again and working hard on that front. And similarly, in Nevada and Hawaii, the other two states in Region 9, they utilize a partnership marketplace where they run their own marketplace but use the federal government's technology backbone as part of the infrastructure for their exchange. So it's really a partnership model. And we've seen, in particular in Nevada this last year, some really excellent growth in terms of enrollment there. So I think Region 9 has a very solid footing in terms of expansion of coverage. And as I go around and meet with all different kinds of people who are working in our healthcare system, because of course one of the things we're doing is bringing more people into the healthcare system, but we're also working to improve that system at the very same time.
Right.
And so one of the important initiatives in HHS is called delivery system reform, which really encompasses the ideas that a really important part of our work under the ACA is making sure that we're getting better care, better value for the healthcare dollar that we spend, and really thinking about how we pay for healthcare and how we can improve that. And then keeping our eye on the prize that the real goal at the end of the day is better health. And how do we bring all of these pieces together to help individuals and communities be healthier? And what I see as I travel around Region 9 is a tremendous initiative, innovation, folks who are really working on all three of those elements of improving how we deliver care, really completely rethinking the delivery of healthcare and how the different pieces of the healthcare system work together, how we coordinate care, how we change models of care so that people really get care in the right place at the right time. A lot of work on changing how we pay for care, thinking about bundled payments. Accountable care organizations are proliferating certainly within Region 9, and we know we've seen some very good success with the Medicare ACOs, where they're both maintaining or even improving quality and at the same time lowering costs through these efforts to really bring all the components of the healthcare system working together in ways that they have not before, part through their coordination, but also changing the financial incentives so that we're really focused on outcomes and value and not just volume. As you know very well, our health system traditionally has paid service by service and the focus is on volume, and we're really working to turn that ship. And I see a lot of work happening in that realm in Region 9. Of course, we have more to do, but I think that is really taking root here in Region 9, and we'll be continuing to want to support that work.
Well, you mentioned, you know, affordability, and I wanted to cite Drew Altman, who is, of course, the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Yes.
He wrote just this week in his Wall Street Journal column that they did a poll of consumers in August who then expressed concern about the rising cost of drugs. You mentioned the donut hole. But the rising cost of drugs as the tip of the iceberg of a larger concern they have about out-of-pocket costs. What other plans does HHS have or initiatives underway to help lower the cost of healthcare?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And as we talked about, it's incredibly important because continuing to work on improving affordability of care is really central to our work, to getting more people covered, but also to creating a sustainable health system, as you mentioned a few minutes ago. So there's a couple of things happening. So I think one of the first things is what I mentioned in terms of delivery system reform and the work we're doing on payment reform is thinking about the underlying costs of healthcare that then go into the cost of health insurance coverage. And so we have to continue to do that work to really think about how do we get better value for the healthcare dollar that we spend. So a major initiative within HHS is the secretary a few months ago announced a series of very concrete goals within the Medicare program within fee-for-service to have an increasingly high percentage of those payments be connected to quality and to alternative payment methodologies that specifically pay for value and outcomes. And the intent of that is to really help bring the entire industry together and point in the same direction toward payment models and payment systems that do shift from that more historical volume-based approach to this value and outcomes-based approach. But building on that, the idea is not to just do that in the Medicare program. We want that to spread to other parts of the industry. And through the Secretary and CMS, we created something called the Learning and Action Network. And actually, anybody can join that. So if you go to the CMS website and put in Learning and Action Network, you can just provide a little information about your name and your email, and you can get signed up for that. And that is really intended to have this nationwide conversation about what approaches to improving how we deliver care, the model of care, and what kind of payment reforms are really effective, be it in Medicare, in partnership with states through the Medicaid program, Medi-Cal here in California, and in the private sector. And so that conversation is happening and will continue and will keep growing. And there's a series of webinars you can join on that. There's regular email updates, and it's really highlighting some of the experiences and best practices and, candidly, the things that don't work. I'm a big believer that you have to look at the things that didn't work mm-hmm. because we can learn a lot from that. And that's a really vibrant conversation that's happening. So I definitely encourage people to explore the Learning and Action Network. The other thing we're doing in terms of affordability with respect to the federal exchange, the federally funded marketplace as we get ready for open enrollment, is we saw, and I saw this personally at many, many enrollment events I attended last winter, which we all know health insurance is incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. You pay a premium and a deductible and a copay, and well, what's different from a copay and a deductible? Wait a minute. And, you know, you get, it's bronze, gold, silver, you know, it's confusing. Mm-hmm. It's complicated. It's got a lot of pieces to it. And one of the things we know that's really important about making sure that people get the right health plan that's affordable for themselves and their families, but also makes sense for them in terms of their own healthcare needs, is to really have an educated consumer. And so we are working to provide more tools and information to consumers as they make decisions about what health plan makes sense for them. And one of the things we're planning for the upcoming open enrollment period as part of the federal marketplace is a tool, an online tool that will help consumers estimate their total out-of-pocket costs if they choose a particular plan.
See, because they were not getting that when they would pick a bronze plan and they didn't realize how much out-of-pocket, the co-pays, the drugs, the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit human nature to pay attention to just the monthly premium, because most of us think about our bills kind of in that monthly way. And so I think there was a lot of focus on premium, which is, of course, is incredibly important.
Right.
But so is the deductible, which is, of course, the amount you pay before certain benefits kick in where they're paid for, and the amount you have to pay as a copay each time you go for a visit or if you do go to the emergency room. And this will help. So if I'm a person with a chronic disease like diabetes, and I know that I need to go to the doctor or the nurse practitioner regularly to help manage my care, I'm going to have more visits. Mm-hmm. I probably have more prescriptions, and I can help fold that into this cost calculator and then choose a plan that might be the best match for me rather than just thinking about a particular monthly premium.
Say again where this tool will be
available? It will be online at healthcare.gov when we start open enrollment for the federal marketplace. There will also be some tools to help people consider whether the prescription drugs that they take and whether the physician that they use is in the plan that they might want to choose. And it will let people, I think, shop more effectively with more information and more tools to help them make decisions to really enhance that decision about affordability and choosing a plan that makes sense for you.
Given that California has its own exchange.
Yeah.
Is there a tool similar to this? Because they wouldn't necessarily go to healthcare.gov. They know Covered California.
They're going to go to Covered California. Right. You know, I don't know that they have that specific tool, but one of the things that's a little bit different about Covered California is it has a very structured approach to the way plans can offer so that all of the benefits are quite comparable. Mm-hmm. And that is a little different than the structure of the federal marketplace, given that it works with many different states and the plans vary by state. So I do think that Covered California does a really terrific job
comparing apples to apples
of different plans that consumers can really look at and understand. If I choose, you know, plan A versus plan B, how is that going to affect me, both in terms of the out-of-pocket costs I might have, but the network I might have? I think they've really worked hard to bring some of that clarity through the structure that they've brought to the Covered California marketplace.
Interesting, interesting. Well, speaking of Medicare and Medicaid, we just, of course, celebrated the 50th anniversary.
Yes, which was fantastic.
Which is fantastic. And few people realize that these two programs, Medicare and Medicaid, which now seem so normal, faced bitter opposition, much like the ACA faces. Do you think the ACA will ever reach a state of normal?
You know, I already see signs of that happening, and I'll tell you how. One of the ways is that as people are preparing, for example, for this next open enrollment, a lot of the strategies around helping folks re-enroll in coverage who already signed up, but also people who have not yet signed up for coverage who are eligible, is rather than thinking about it as sort of a separate effort, it's really being embedded into a lot of other work and ways that folks interact with different kinds of services. So I was just in Arizona earlier this week, and one of the big strategies they're working on for open enrollment is partnerships with schools, because that's a trusted place for families to get information. So for low and moderate income families who may not yet have health insurance, they can get information about coverage for themselves and their children through these partnerships. Well, there'll just be more information provided about what the opportunities are. And so I see it sort of spreading out into many ways in the community where that information about getting health coverage is becoming more routine, I guess, and it's okay. Sort of part of the fabric. Yeah, exactly, of what's already happening in the community. Mm-hmm. And we work, for example, internally within the federal government with the Head Start program that's part of HHS to make sure that families who have children in Head Start get information about health care coverage and their options under the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. So I think that is, the other thing we know that word of mouth is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. We trust our family members, we trust our friends, we trust our neighbors. And so as more folks have experience of going through the process of getting health coverage and then equally, if not more importantly, than actually accessing healthcare, hopefully primary care and preventive services, they'll be able to, you know, talk about that around the dinner table or at the, you know, barbecue at the local park. And mm-hmm. I've been to this year a number of church events and different sort of areas related to nutrition and farmers markets, and people there are talking about and helping people get signed up for health coverage because it's part of the routines of people's lives. So I already see signs of that. And I think for myself, my focus is on very much, you know, it's at this point in my mind, health reform and helping people get coverage, it's about human beings. Mm-hmm. It's about those 16 million faces that I try to imagine. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the focus, is human beings who need health care coverage and access to health care, and how can we get there.
So how many do we have left to go? We talked about open enrollment, and I know that's coming up. And what are the goals for open enrollment this time around?
Yeah. So there's a couple of goals we have in Region 9, of course. And we know that the Medicaid expansions, of course, are ongoing. And so that process will, you know, continue in terms of folks being able to stay enrolled in Medicaid.
They can enroll
any time of year.
Right.
Exactly, Leslie. Exactly. And there are renewal processes for that, but that's ongoing. And so I think we will see that continuing. And we have seen not only people who are newly eligible enroll in Medicaid programs, but people who were eligible even before the ACA but hadn't yet enrolled. I think because of all the information that's been provided, mm-hmm. it's even helped more people get into the Medicaid program, which is really terrific. And then in terms of open enrollment, getting ready for open enrollment, I think we are definitely ratcheting up our energy and our attention and our planning to really get ready for open enrollment. And certainly Covered California is doing that here as well. And I think one of the things we'll see this open enrollment period is we really try to reach the population, as I said, that's between 138 and 400% of poverty, because those folks are eligible for federal subsidies that really help make coverage much more affordable. I think our efforts are getting more targeted, more sophisticated to those who we know still remain uninsured. But that really does vary a lot by state, not only by region in the country, but even by state. Who are the populations that we have not yet seen enroll at the rates that we would want to see? And so in different states, that's varying. But I do think you're seeing efforts, be it through schools, be it through working with different faith-based groups, community groups, chambers of commerce, all kinds of different groups, consumer advocate groups, who really are out in the community on a regular basis and really getting folks connected to the information that they need to then sign up. So I think we're going to see a series of very targeted efforts. And of course, a very big focus on everybody who already signed up, making sure they have the information they need to get re-enrolled and stay in coverage. Right. They can change their plan, of course, if there's another plan that they think would make more sense for them. They absolutely have the opportunity to do that. But we want to support them in getting re-enrolled.
So how have retention rates been? We only have a couple of years under our belt here, how are retention rates with people who enroll?
Yeah, they look pretty good. I mean, I think we just announced that in the federal marketplace and the data that we had for some of the state marketplaces, about 9.9 million people this year have effectuated coverage, which means that at the end of the day, all their paperwork was completed and accepted. They've paid their premiums because, as you know, there is a premium that has to be paid by folks who are enrolled in the marketplaces, either the state or the federal marketplace. And that's on track with what our goals were in terms of HHS at that level to see that. And I think, as I said, we're working very hard to make the systems sort of as much of a well-oiled machine as we can for this upcoming enrollment so people can re-enroll as simple as possible in terms of the system, you know, kind of pre-populating all their information. Mm-hmm. It will be as simple as we can make it for folks to re-enroll in coverage for the coming year.
Well, that's exciting. Hopefully it'll turn out well. How many do you project? What is your goal for Region 9?
We're still working through that, but I think it will continue to increase, and I really think we're going to continue to see more progress. Now, one of the things you often hear people say is that, there's probably some truth to this, is that the folks who were most likely had been uninsured and were in greatest need or most likely to get coverage have already signed up. And given that we know we've covered an additional 16 million people, that's probably true. So the folks who do not yet have coverage are probably some of the harder to reach populations. Mm-hmm. And so we know that our work is going to be even more challenging actually going forward. We have the benefit of lessons learned from our work to date, but we also know that the folks who are left who haven't signed up yet probably need, maybe it could be more information, it could be more support, it could be more targeted efforts to get into communities where we know we haven't reached. That could be
sort of
rural areas.
Peer-to-peer.
We certainly see that potentially in rural areas. Mm-hmm. One of the important roles of HHS is actually working on the health and human services needs in partnership with our tribal nations, with our Native American populations. We know we have more work to do in Region 9 there to provide the information and the support that's needed to help folks get signed up for coverage. So we know the work is going to get harder, but I think we can take those lessons learned and take some of these targeted approaches and continue to make headway.
Well, that's exciting. Let's hope it works.
Yes.
As I mentioned, this has been a big week in healthcare news, so I want to be sure we get to some of the other topics, for one of which was the Surgeon General issued a call to address major public health challenges such as heart disease and diabetes through walking.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
I can. I'm very excited about this call to action for walkability by our Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy. So one of the things that we know is that actually a relatively small amount of exercise goes a long way in improving our health. And so my understanding is the statistic is that just an average of 22 minutes a day of physical activity, 22 minutes only, can show a marked reduction in the risk of heart disease and diabetes. And so we really are, with this call to action, encouraging people to walk or roll, folks in wheelchairs.
That was very interesting.
Yes, very important. Absolutely. Rollability is key, too, to really get that physical activity going. And so there are a number of components to that. Of course, one is just inspiring us each individually to take that action or, you know, grab a buddy and get out there and walk, be it at a break we have or a lunch break or anything that we can do. But it's also thinking more at a community level about how do we create communities that are safe for walkability and rollability. And we know that that's a very real issue in many communities in terms of...
We've been working on that in San Diego for years.
Yes, you have. Yeah. And it makes a huge difference, though, to the ability of individuals in the community to really, I think, create that dynamic where walking places is a sort of a standard way, a safe way, a realistic way of transportation, of having that or building that into somebody's daily and weekly life. So we really want to do that. And you may have heard the Surgeon General, who has a terrific sense of humor, also included a what do you call it? A playlist, a Pandora playlist for people.
Yeah, I was listening to it.
Yeah, so make your own playlist, mm-hmm. get some music that you absolutely love and inspire you to go walking. So, and then the other thing, of course, is we're going to continue our work in terms of research and analysis about how it is that we can continue to support physical activity, which we know is so incredibly important mm-hmm. to people's health. And I know I personally, when I can't fit in every day, take the stairs. So I think even just doing simple things like that, trying to build it into our lives is really important.
The trick is ever to find the stairs.
It is.
You know, I mean, I'm all about taking
but I have to tell you, so I was recently in the state of Hawaii building for the Department of Health, and they have made their stairwells more welcoming than their elevators. By the signage, by where they're located, they have pictures in their stairwells of different sort of cultural traditions and of their community. They have music playing in the stairwells. So there are actually pretty simple things that we can all do to make walking and taking the stairs more of a way of life. The other thing I should say is this call to action is not for walkability, is not a one-day kind of thing. You know, sometimes these initiatives get a lot of attention for one day, and this week we're so excited that the Surgeon General made this call to action. But this initiative around walkability is really a long-term focus on how to increase physical activity, because we just know that's a central part of being healthy, both physically and mentally.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, that's, of course, a great initiative on the preventive side. Mm-hmm. Now, when we go to the treatment side, and when the president announced in his State of the Union address in 2015 a precision medicine initiative.
Right.
Can you tell us what precision medicine means?
Sure, sure. So precision medicine is really comes out of the incredible advances we've had in healthcare research and technology and works in genetics, where the idea is that a person's disease can be essentially sort of decoded from a genetic standpoint, and then the treatment can be tailored to that specific person based on, say, if it's a person with cancer, the genetics of their tumor, or if it was started off as sort of a genetic disease that they were born with that actually deals with the genetics of that particular disease in that person. So it's precision medicine. It's sometimes called personalized medicine because it's tailored precisely to that person's need. And so the president did propose in his budget to a little over $200 million, I believe it was $215 million, mm-hmm. to fund this new precision medicine initiative. And that would allow us to do a couple of things. So some of that money would go through the National Cancer Institute to further develop the testing methodologies and have the ability to actually sequence the genome of a million people, because having that underlying basis for research and then to really being able to target treatment, we need to have that sort of base for the research. And one of the things that's happened is that, of course, the cost of genetic sequencing has declined significantly mm-hmm. over the last several years. And so it's making an initiative like this possible. And then the other thing, of course, is that we need to develop really a regulatory framework around this to support, of course, the important issues around privacy and really making sure that treatments, of course, are safe. And so really developing that regulatory framework as well that would support the precision medicine initiative. So that is a really important proposal in the president's budget that we're certainly hoping to see ultimately funded and proceed.
Well, that's very interesting that they talk about a million volunteers
yes.
To create a cohort, a yep. national research cohort.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by that and wonder how they would recruit those volunteers who will then share their genetic data, biological samples, diet, lifestyle information, and all of that. That's fascinating. I think I would volunteer.
Yeah, I mean,
but I don't know
how
that
would
go
on a volunteer basis. I guess the way I think about that is I'm guessing that all of us have somebody, a family member or a friend who has had, it could be a cancer or an underlying genetic disease where mm-hmm. we would do anything that we could to help that person. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe part of what will inspire people to volunteer is knowing that their ability, if they participate in this, that they're helping to move forward the longer-term research to address those really critical diseases.
Well, I'll be very interested to hear how
And I'm thrilled
happens.
To hear that you might volunteer.
That's
fantastic.
I think that's really interesting. Another big item in the news this week was the and proposed rule that was announced by your boss, Secretary yeah. Burwell, related to non-discrimination in health programs and activities.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about a little bit about that rule and why it's needed?
Yeah. So one of the things, and you've actually seen a couple of different initiatives in the past year around this, of course, is really making sure that the LGBTQ community is fully included and not discriminated against in our health system. And so this rule is going toward looking at that issue of gender identity. And mm-hmm. So, you know, it's obviously, and here in Region 9, we know there's really a lot of important work happening in terms of LGBTQ research within the health system and a lot of really important research that can be done, but also making sure that healthcare needs of that population are being met appropriately.
I understand. Yeah. I think that's very exciting work.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm sure very much welcome.
Yes.
And
I hope so.
Disparities, you know, come in so many different varieties, and,
yes.
and I know that there are many initiatives to reduce those disparities. Are
yes.
there any in particular that you want to share?
Yeah, health disparities is such an important issue. As you say, from many different vantage points. It could be from an LGBTQ standpoint. It could be based on race and ethnicity. We know we see disparities. And so actually, you know, one of the things that we are seeing is even just coverage expansion and getting people connected to primary care and preventive services. A big part of that is being able to manage chronic disease like diabetes or asthma more effectively. And those chronic diseases are some of the diseases where we see very significant disparities, heart disease. And so we actually think we are making a difference in terms of addressing disparities, even with these macro proposals through the Affordable Care Act of getting people covered and connected to primary care. And so I think that's incredibly important. And then as I'm out in the field, I definitely hear about different initiatives that folks are working on to reduce disparities that make sense, you know, for their geographic population.
Got it. Yeah. Well, so many exciting things happening in healthcare.
I know. I feel really so fortunate to get to do the work that I do.
I can understand that. You know, I was talking to a CEO who I wondered how he was feeling and if he had trouble sleeping at night, and he thought this was the most exciting time there was to be in healthcare. So I'm hopeful that other people will understand that as well, and these results will continue to show why.
Yeah, and I think that there's no doubt that tremendous challenges remain and that we have more work to do mm-hmm. to improve our healthcare system, get more people covered. I mean, we have more work to do. We still have things to improve. But I think we are starting from such an improved base than before we had the ACA. As somebody mm-hmm. who worked in the healthcare safety net for the last two decades, I mean, I know somebody I worked with very closely who was on the verge of retirement. And I actually just met a woman this week who told me the same story. She was on the verge of retirement, and then the ACA passed. And both of them said to me, I've been working for 30 years to get expanded coverage in our country. I'm not leaving now. I'm going to stay. And now we're going to do the hard work of implementing this really important program, which we know large programs take time to implement. But I think we really are seeing this progress of moving forward. And I hope that inspires lots of people to keep their sleeves rolled up and keep doing this work to make healthcare more accessible and affordable for everyone, and reach that goal at the end of the day of really improving health status. Because when I go out in the field and talk with folks, we did a series of different kinds of meetings and roundtables and events over the summer about really connecting with folks in communities about how do we translate healthcare coverage into access to care and better health. How do we do that? What does mm-hmm. that look like? Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of steps that are helpful to people in that? And I was so moved by what really inspired people, whether I was at a farmer's market or a church or in a round table with room of professionals who have spent their whole careers on prevention. It really is that focus on health, because we know when you have your health, you can look for a job that's really meaningful for you. You can take care of your family. Your life is more stable. Health is so core to our overall well-being and living the life that we feel like we're really meant to live. And that really inspires people to think about, how do I translate this health coverage into better health for individuals in the community? And I know that's what keeps me inspired.
Well, on that very uplifting note, I will say thank you for joining
me. Thank you,
Leslie. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure having you help celebrate our 3 years of podcasts. And I want to thank you, listeners. To be notified of future podcasts, go to UCSD Extension, or to go to, excuse me, extension.ucsd.edu. Click on My Extension, provide your email address, and we'll keep you posted. If you have any suggestions about who you'd like to hear me interview, please email me at careerchannel@ucsd.edu. For now, this is Leslie Bruce, and here's to your health.